Like when your smartphone glitches or an app just keeps crashing on you, there's a very predictable protocol we all follow.
Oh yeah, you just download a patch.
Right. You download the patch, you restart the device, and boom, the software is instantly updated. It's comforting, honestly.
It really is.
But when your life glitches, when you're suddenly overwhelmed by, I don't know, constant notifications or this gnawing professional jealousy or just like a heavy blanket of existential dread, there is no download button.
No, definitely not. There's no quick fix for that.
There is no simple patch for our internal operating system, which is probably why today we're seeing people from forensic psychologists to symphony violinists turning to, a 2,500-year-old framework to troubleshoot their modern lives. I'm talking about Buddhism.
Yeah, it's super fascinating.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we are taking a stack of really intimate personal accounts to answer one central question. Why are people drawn to this ancient practice today?
It's a question that reveals a lot about our current moment, I think. And what you find when you look through these sources is that there's absolutely no single gateway into this stuff.
Right, it's not a monolith.
Exactly. We aren't just looking at, accounts of monks meditating on remote mountain peaks. We are looking at working professionals who are deeply embedded in the absolute chaos of modern society.
Just regular people.
Yeah. And for some of them, the entry point into these practices was this intense, completely unexplainable personal crisis.
Like a shock to the system.
Right. While for others, it was a highly practical, almost clinical search for a system that could actually process the exacting demands of their everyday lives.
So I want you, the person listening to this right now, to think about what drives you to seek out new knowledge. When you look for a new philosophy or even just like a new productivity hack, is it driven by pure curiosity?
Or is it a desperate need to solve a specific grinding problem?
Exactly. Because the people in our sources often took that very first step into this ancient tradition, not out of some detached academic interest, but because they were basically thrown into the deep end.
They were, yeah.
We see these dramatic, highly unexpected collisions between modern life and ancient practices. I mean, take the story of Aaron, for instance.
Oh, Aaron's experience is the absolute definition of a collision. So he was 18 years old, right on the edge of heading off to college, and he somehow got his hands on a book about yoga.
Just a standard book?
Well, yes, but he started experimenting with the advanced breathwork exercises detailed in the back of the book.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, these are practices where the author explicitly warns the reader, like, do not attempt these without an experienced teacher.
But of course, being an invincible 18-year-old,
He did them anyway,
eventually.
and it triggered what is known in these traditions as a Kundalini awakening.
Which, I mean, that sounds incredibly mystical and peaceful, right? But the way he describes it was a terrifying physiological and psychological event.
Very much so. It's not a joke. In these traditions, Kundalini is understood as a dormant, highly concentrated energy resting at the base of the spine.
Okay.
And when it's awakened prematurely, without the proper physical or ethical foundation, it doesn't feel like a peaceful wave of enlightenment. It feels like a severe shock to the nervous system.
And he goes off to college right after this happens, right? So he's living the standard college lifestyle.
Yeah, drinking, smoking, casual sex, late night parties.
Right. And he describes this newly awakened, high-frequency internal energy violently clashing with his external environment. I think he said it made him feel borderline psychotic.
Which makes sense. His nervous system was essentially rejecting his lifestyle,
Yeah.
and he was completely ungrounded.
It's like he was forcing a massive voltage of spiritual energy into a vessel, his 18-year-old self, that was just entirely unprepared for it.
Exactly. The energy demanded a level of purity and focus, but his environment was absolute chaos. So to survive it, he had to actively seek out rigorous Ashtanga yoga.
And he ended up spending significant time in intense Zen monasteries, right?
He did, yes.
So the monastery wasn't a relaxing retreat for him. It was basically a heavy-duty transformer. I mean, if you take a cheap desk lamp and plug it straight into an industrial power line, the bulb shatters.
That's a great way to put it.
You need a mechanism to step down that voltage. But how does a Zen monastery actually do that? Like, logistically?
It does it through relentless physical structure.
Okay.
In a traditional Zen setting, every single second of your day is dictated. You wake up at a specific time, you chop wood, you sweep
You
floors.
sit in a rigid posture.
Yes, and you bow a very specific number of times. By entirely removing the burden of choice and cognitive overload, the nervous system is finally allowed to reset.
I see.
The physical exhaustion and the strict discipline essentially ground that erratic mental energy back into the physical body. It was a literal survival mechanism for Aaron.
Wow. Okay. That makes perfect sense for someone trying to manage a, you know, supernatural overload. But I have to push back a bit here. I have to imagine that's a pretty rare entry point. Are people only drawn to this because of wild, mystical experiences? What about someone who is perfectly grounded?
That's a really fair question.
Someone who isn't looking for a spiritual lifeline at all, but who still ends up captivated by this ancient system.
Well, that brings us to another account from our sources, a working veterinarian named Jackie.
Okay.
Jackie's entry was the exact opposite of Aaron's chaotic college experience. She was raised in a Christian household, but had eventually settled into being a firm agnostic and a scientist.
So definitely not seeking anything spiritual.
Not at all.
Yeah.
But she still had this bizarre catalyst. She had an incredibly vivid, visceral dream about a Tibetan monk sitting in her garden.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and people were leaving gifts for her in the dream. And it was so real, so impactful, that she woke up, drove straight to a half-price bookstore, and bought every single book on Tibetan Buddhism she could find in the discount aisle.
I love that. Moving straight from a mystical vision to the bargain bin.
It's a wonderful image, isn't it? But what is truly insightful is what kept her actually reading those books.
Right, because the dream gets you in the door, but it doesn't keep you there.
Exactly. The dream was the spark, but the structure is what held her. As an atheist and a medical professional, she was deeply drawn to the fact that Buddhism didn't ask her to rely on an external god sitting in the clouds deciding her fate.
She found a lot of comfort in the idea that in this tradition, everyone is already a born Buddha.
Yes. The concept that the fundamental nature of the mind is already clear and enlightened. It's just temporarily clouded by our human habits, traumas, and cultural conditioning.
Which makes sense.
For a highly educated scientist like Jackie, this wasn't a matter of blind faith. It was a logical, step-by-step curriculum for attaining wisdom.
It's essentially an empirical practice, right? Like, you are given a set of mental tools, you test them on your own mind, and you observe the results.
Precisely. It completely bypassed the conflict she felt between her atheism and her desire for a spiritual framework.
Okay, so if this philosophy holds up to the scrutiny of a scientific mind like Jackie's, how does it hold up against raw, petty, everyday human emotion?
The daily grind.
Exactly. Because understanding the fundamental nature of the mind is great. But what happens when you are just furiously jealous of a coworker?
That is where the practice shifts from, you know, high-minded philosophy to what we might actually call mental martial arts.
Mental martial arts. I like that.
And we see this perfectly illustrated by Joe Evans. He's a professional violinist in the Utah Symphony.
Which is an intense job. Professional orchestras are notoriously intensely competitive environments.
Oh, incredibly. You are spending hours every day sitting inches away from someone who desperately wants your chair.
And that kind of constant low-level threat took a real toll on him. Joe started suffering from recurring, highly vivid dreams of tornadoes tearing through his life.
Yeah, and he finally brought this up with his teacher, Kenpo Choga Rinpoche.
And his teacher's diagnosis was super fascinating.
It really was. He didn't offer a mystical interpretation of the dreams at all. He diagnosed the tornadoes as an imbalance of the wind element.
The wind element.
Yeah. In Tibetan medicine and psychology, the mind and the vital energy, often called wind or prana, they move together.
Okay, I follow.
So when the mind is severely agitated by a gripping emotion like professional jealousy, those internal winds become chaotic.
And that internal chaos was literally manifesting as tornadoes in Joe's subconscious.
Exactly.
I mean, professional jealousy is such a universal poison. You log onto a professional network, you see a colleague's promotion, and you get that hot tightness in your chest.
We've all been there.
But the prescription his teacher gave him sounds almost impossible to actually do.
It's definitely challenging. He told Joe to use the exact opposite emotion, rejoicing and love for his colleague's success, as a direct antidote.
How does that even work?
It relies on a very specific cognitive mechanism. In this framework, jealousy and genuine joy cannot occupy the mind at the exact same moment.
They're mutually exclusive.
So whenever Joe felt that bitter resentment bubbling up while listening to an amazing violinist sit next to him, he had to actively force his brain to generate love and happiness for his colleague's success.
Which means instead of letting the resentment fester into a tornado, He had to sit there and actively think, I am so glad they play beautifully. They earned that.
Right.
By consciously forcing that thought, he is literally starving the neural pathway of jealousy.
Precisely. You are actively rewiring the response. And according to Joe, it worked.
That's amazing.
He stopped being destroyed by the competition and started actually absorbing the good qualities of the musicians around him.
Okay, so that handles the workplace. But what happens when you bring these tools into the living room?
Well, we have an account from Jude and Emma for that.
Right. They were both raised Catholic, but have essentially woven these Buddhist concepts into the fabric of modern parenting.
Yeah, they use these profound philosophical concepts for the most mundane, hair-pulling parental struggles.
Like what?
Imagine young boys scraping a knee in public and having a screaming meltdown, or having an absolute fit because their character just died in the video game Fortnite.
Oh, man. Normally, a parent just yells, stop crying, it's just a game.
Exactly. But Jude and Emma use those exact moments to teach impermanence. They actively remind the kids, and let's be honest, they are reminding themselves that this pain will pass.
Right. They are teaching their kids to observe a feeling fade rather than completely identifying with it.
And Jude takes it a step further with his own identity. He works as a forensic psychologist.
Which is a heavy field.
It is. It's a field that requires navigating intense legal and academic arenas. It requires a very strong armored ego to defend your testimonies and publish your research.
He calls it his LinkedIn ego.
It's a brilliant term, isn't it? We all construct these professional personas. But Jude actively uses his practice to shed that LinkedIn ego before he walks into his house.
He just drops the degrees, the titles, and the defensive armor so he can just be a dad sitting on the floor with his kids.
Exactly. He leaves the professional identity at the door.
I see the utility in all of this. I really do. But I have to push back a little again.
Of what?
Hearing about Joe fixing his jealousy and Jude managing his kids' Fortnite tantrums, it sounds very clinical. It sounds a lot like cognitive behavioral therapy.
I can see why you'd say that.
So if it's just a psychological toolkit for managing daily stress, why do they need the whole massive Buddhist framework? Like, why do they need the ancient texts and the complex concepts? Couldn't they just go to weekly therapy and get the exact same result?
It's a really fair question.
Mm-hmm.
And therapy is incredibly valuable, of course.
Yeah.
But it operates on a different fundamental premise.
How so?
In therapy, the goal is often to repair, strengthen, or understand the self.
Yeah.
The Buddhist framework isn't just designed to make yourself feel a little less stressed.
What's it designed to do then?
It's designed to fundamentally investigate and eventually deconstruct the illusion that a permanent, independent self even exists at all.
But how does that actually play out in a normal life, though? Deconstructing the self sounds like something you do in a cave, not in a 20-year marriage.
Well, look at how Jude describes his marriage to Emma. He says they are not two rigid, independent individuals functioning in a bubble.
Right.
He describes their relationship as a co-constructed glob of interdependent habits.
A co-constructed glob.
Yes.
I mean, that might not make it onto a romantic greeting card, but there is something deeply profound about that image.
It really is a perfect practical application of the Buddhist concept of emptiness. And emptiness doesn't mean a dark void. It means that nothing exists independently. Everything is interdependent.
Okay, I think I've gotten it.
If Jude views his marriage as two solid billiard balls crashing into each other, every argument is a clash of rigid egos.
Right.
But if he understands that they are a dynamic fluid glob, he realizes that if he changes his own reaction, the entire structure of the relationship shifts.
It's a completely different lens for viewing reality,
right,
which is why the broader philosophical framework is so necessary.
Exactly.
Okay, so we've moved from grounding chaotic energy to surviving office politics to navigating marriage.
A pretty wide spectrum.
Yeah. But the ultimate test of any framework isn't just how it makes a Tuesday afternoon slightly more manageable.
No, it's not.
It is how it equips you to face the absolute harshest, most terrifying realities of human existence. And that brings us to the final layer of why people are drawn to this practice, confronting systemic illusion and mortality.
Yes. We see this deeply in Aaron's later perspective. So bringing Aaron back into the conversation.
Right, the guy from the beginning.
He argues that modern culture is essentially a house of cards, built on lies, exploitation, capitalism.
And to be clear to you, the listener, we are looking at Aaron's perspective here to understand his spiritual journey. We are remaining completely impartial here. We aren't endorsing this political or economic critique.
We're simply reporting his perspective from the source material.
Exactly. But whether or not you agree with his specific political views, what is fascinating is how he uses his practice to process that intense frustration.
That's the key. For Aaron, the Dharma of the Buddha's teachings becomes the ultimate tool for deep discernment.
How does that help him?
Well, when you feel that the societal structures around you are deeply flawed or destructive, it is very easy to fall into despair or blind rage.
Oh, absolutely. It's exhausting.
But Aaron uses the practice to essentially cut through what he sees as the bullshit of society. It allows him to see what is actually true without being consumed by anger.
That kind of discernment requires immense courage. It requires the ability to look at a terrifying reality without flinching or looking away. Which actually brings us back to Jackie, our veterinarian.
Right.
She deals with literal life and death stakes on the operating table.
She does. And Jackie utilizes advanced tantric visualization practices to summon the courage needed for those moments.
Right.
Specifically, she visualizes an archetype known as the Red Garuda.
Which sounds like something out of a fantasy novel, honestly.
Oh.
What does visualizing a mythical bird actually do for a surgeon?
So the Red Garuda is a powerful, fiery, winged healing deity. When Jackie has to perform a critical, highly complex surgery where an animal's life is literally resting in her hands,
yeah,
the human mind's natural response is paralyzing fear.
Right, because making a mistake means death.
Exactly. But by visualizing the Red Garuda, she is engaging in a profound psychological mechanism. She essentially externalizes her fear and steps into an archetype of pure, unshakable confidence.
So the human Jackie might be terrified, but the Red Garuda is not.
Exactly. She channels that archetype to clear her nerves, allowing her medical expertise to flow without the obstruction of panic. She faces intense reality without fear.
It is about creating an avatar to shoulder the burden of fear. That is incredibly powerful.
It really is.
And speaking of life and death, we have to look at the account shared by Kim H.
Yeah.
Kim grew up around these practices because her parents were lifelong seekers. They were Vipassana meditation teachers.
Right.
But the real undeniable proof of the practice came when her father suffered a severe stroke and ended up in the intensive care unit.
An event that would completely shatter the reality of most families.
But Kim said her father faced this terrifying, painful ordeal with absolute grace. He looked at his daughter from the ICU bed and told her there was nothing to fear.
Wow.
He said, "This is just the aging and dying the Buddha talked about."
Think about the mechanics of what is happening there.
Yeah, explain that.
He had spent thousands of hours over decades sitting in meditation, observing small pains arise in his body, acknowledging them, and watching them pass without reacting.
Right.
He trained his mind to accept the reality of decay. So when the ultimate pain came, the muscle memory of his mind simply took over. He faced mortality with ease because he had prepared for this exact reality.
But wait, if we look at Aaron retreating to monasteries because society is a house of cards and Kim's father just calmly accepting a massive stroke.
I know where you're going with this.
Isn't there a danger here? It sounds like people might just be using Buddhism to check out. Like, isn't this just a sophisticated form of escapism, a way to become emotionally numb so you don't have to feel the pain of the world?
It is a very common critique, yes. But the sources push back on this idea of escapism forcefully.
Now so.
Remember Joe Evans, the violinist? He defines true freedom not as escaping reality or chasing a temporary sense pleasure or numbing yourself.
Right.
He defines true freedom as the cessation of negative thinking. You clear the obscurations, the jealousy, the panic, the ego, so that you can engage with the world more fully and effectively, not less.
And Aaron actually addresses the monastery critique directly, right?
He does. He explicitly states that going to a Zen monastery is not about hiding from the world. He calls them training centers.
Training centers.
Yes. You don't retreat to escape. You retreat to train the mind, to build your stamina and clarity, so that when you re-enter the chaos of modern society, you actually have the energy and the tools required to address the suffering around you.
You retreat to train. I really like that.
Yeah.
So let's pull all of this together. We started this deep dive asking why people are drawn to Buddhism today. And the answers are as complex as the people themselves.
They really are.
They're drawn to it, to ground terrifying, chaotic spiritual energy. They are drawn to an empirical, logical curriculum that respects a scientific mind.
Right.
They use it as mental martial arts to survive the fierce tornadoes of workplace jealousy and to parent with patience when their kids lose their minds over Fortnite.
Yes.
And ultimately, they use it to look death in the eye with profound grace.
It is an ancient psychological and spiritual toolkit that is endlessly adaptable to highly specific modern suffering.
So I want you to reflect on your own life right now. Where could you use a little mental martial arts?
What are the tornadoes of jealousy or stress spinning in your own mind right now that need a new antidote?
Exactly. What is your version of the LinkedIn ego that you need to leave at the door when you come home?
And as you think about those tools, consider this final thought. There is a fascinating paradox at the heart of all these stories that wasn't explicitly spelled out in the sources.
Oh, what is it?
Well, the core doctrine of Buddhism is anatta, or non-self, the idea that the independent ego is an illusion. Yet look at what people are doing. Jackie the veterinarian, Joe the violinist, Jude the psychologist, they're all utilizing this ancient doctrine of no-self to become demonstrably better, more resilient, and more effective versions of themselves in their highly individualized careers and lives.
That's wow.
We're using a philosophy of complete selflessness to essentially upgrade the self. If these ancient practices developed thousands of years ago in isolated caves and silent monasteries are perfectly solving the anxieties of our hyper-connected digital age, what does that tell us about the human mind?
I guess it tells us that perhaps our external technology evolves at lightning speed, but our internal software hasn't changed at all.
Exactly.
We use the absence of ego to become better at our jobs and better in our marriages. That's a lot to think about. Keep troubleshooting, keep questioning, and we'll see you on the next deep dive.